The man who sows little reaps little, and the man who wants a good harvest should scatter his seed where it will yield him a hundredfold. For good seed withers and dies in poor soil. Christian sows and plants the seed of a romance he is beginning, and sows it on such good ground that it cannot but yield a fine harvest, for he does it on behalf of the worthiest man in the Empire of Rome. This man is Philip, Count of Flanders, whose worthiness surpasses that of Alexander. People say that Alexander was so great, but I shall demonstrate that the Count's worthiness surpasses that of Alexander, who embodied all vices and all evils from which the Count is safe and free. The Count is one who does not listen to base buffoonery or silly chatter. Slander about anyone disturbs him. The Count loves righteousness and justice, loyalty and holy church, and despises all baseness. None knows the extent of his generosity, for he gives without hypocrisy or guile, according to the gospel, which says, "Let not thy left hand know the good thy right hand doth." His generosity is known only to its recipients and to God, who knows all the secrets of men's hearts and sees all the hidden recesses of their being. And why does the gospel say, "Hide from thy left hand thy good deeds"? Because according to Holy Scripture, the left hand signifies vanity that comes from base hypocrisy. And what does the right signify? Charity, which boasts not of its good works, but conceals them so that none knows of them except him who is both God and charity. God is charity, and according to Scripture, St. Paul says it, "And with him I say, the man who dwelleth in charity dwelleth in God, and God in him." Hello and welcome. I'm Douglas Walls, and this is 42 Minutes, a podcast about meaning from SyncBook Radio and distributed by thesyncbook.com. You can find our archives at 42minutes.com, and you can reach us by sending a message to mail@42minutes.com. You can also follow our tweets at Sync42 and at SyncBook. It's Friday, September 20th, 2024. Happy Equinox. And the Holy Grail, 'neath ancient Rosalind waits. The blade and chalice guarding over her gates. Adorned by master's loving art she lies. She rests at last beneath the starry skies. Or that was what we thought in 2003. 800 years later, a mysterious grail, wondrous, but not unequivocally holy, first appears in Percival, the story of the Grail, an unfinished romance written by Chrétien de Troyes around 1190. Chrétien's story inspired many continuations, translators, and interpreters in the later 12th and early 13th century, including Wolfram von Eschenbach, who portrayed the Grail as a stone in Parsifal. The Christian, Celtic, or possibly other origins of the Arthurian Grail trope are uncertain and have been debated among literary scholars and historians. And that is what we will do this evening. Welcome, Znor. Welcome, Klaus. Where did the Grail come from? Who can take a crack at that one?
You're starting on the easy questions.
I have something to posit. We talk about the Gospels so much as they relate to literature and how it filters in. And the Gospels are obviously the good news, right? The transcendental, hyperdimensional good news. And the Gospels were written about Christ, who emerged circa 33 AD or to 1 AD or whatever. But I keep going back to this fact that the first daily newspaper emerged in around 50 BC in the Roman Empire. And the daily newspaper is this somewhat bottomless cup of information, noise, whatever it may be, but it's sort of the concrescence of the kingdom in a daily square format? What more of an analog screen can we get than 50 BC? These daily screeds of the kingdom and a holy grail, a holy bottomless well of information would certainly be something that would quench the thirst of the daily man. And I hate to always bring it back to media, but it does feel media based that some inanimate object could project or communicate something from an inanimate source. What more of a miracle do you want than that, right? So does a media based perspective leap to your forefront with this, or are we going to go more Freudian, where the grail is the bottomless cup of a woman's love, right? The mother's love, the wife's love, the partner's love. I mean, where do you seemingly sit with that grail interpretation?
Yeah, the it's so easy to get all over the place with this, you know. It's hard to know where to start, right? Like, so Doug, you talked about before about kind of the different modern interpretations of what the Grail is and where it came from, and the whole King Arthur stories, and it comes down to kind of three, right? There's more than three, but three main ones, right? The first is kind of the usual one we think of is the Grail being the Holy Grail being the cup of Jesus during the Last Supper, right? And then it was also used to collect the blood of Christ when Christ was on the cross. And then afterwards, the story continues through this figure called Joseph of Arimathea, who was able to purchase the body of Christ or look after the body of Christ after the crucifixion. But he was subsequently arrested, imprisoned for being a follower of Christ. And then Christ appeared to him in prison, presenting him again with this grail. And then, so the continuation is through that, yeah, through this tradition of Joseph of Arimathea. And the earliest record of this is kind of from the book of Nicodemus, right, which is kind of an apocryphal text, kind of a Gnostic gospel. But it's hard to find any Christian tradition of the Grail that leads up to the period that we're talking about, which is the 12th century. Like, it's hard to find this, like, a continuity of tradition that leads all the way up to the 12th century, including with art, including with other scriptures or whatever. And so it's hard to find any mention of the Grail, even any artistic depictions of the Grail in that period, right? In the period from Christ to up to the 11th or 12th century, right? Especially the 12th century with Kirchner. And so that's kind of a problem with that interpretation, right? And then the other interpretation is that it was it's coming from Celtic mythology, especially from more directly from Welsh mythology. And then if you go back, it's Irish mythology, right? Like and then somehow that mythology enters into France, especially through Brittany, right? And it becomes this huge sort of basis from which the poets at that time, the troubadours and trouvères, could use as a basis for their own art. And that starts to become the matter of France. The matter of Britain, which is the Arthurian legends. But there's problems with that interpretation too. Like, how did the Christian element enter into it as well? And then the third take is comes later, especially with people like Jesse Weston, who we talked about last time, and she's who T.S. Eliot sort of highlighted in The Wasteland, and her book was in Apocalypse Now. The Yellow Book was in Apocalypse Now, and her theory, she's basically a follower of Fraser, and she thinks that the Grail stories kind of from a Fraserian interpretation of myth, that behind every myth there is a ritual involved. It starts with a ritual and then becomes a myth. And so her interpretation was that it was a ritual. So this gets called the ritual theory of the Grail. And the ritual that she's talking about was associated with these ancient mystery cults, ancient fertility cults, like Bill was just talking about. And so the idea of the Grail as the female symbol, and then the lance, which is always coupled with it, is the male symbol. And so that symbolism goes way back. And her theory has the strength of being able to incorporate both the Celtic theory and the Christian theory, because they all have this kind of fertility myth basis to them in one way of reading, right? But there are criticisms, big criticisms of her theory as well. So it's like, it's kind of a convergence of all of these things and other things that are happening. So, but if we add another media theory to it, then yeah, the problem is it's still that continuity gap between the time of Christ and then the 12th century.
Well, let's talk about the continuity a little bit. So Chrétien, for all intents and purposes, is the first historical Grail story, correct?
Right.
The Mabinogion, or Mabin, I can't ever say it.
Mabinogion.
Mabinogion, that's how you say it. It is the same source. It really seems like Chrétien and the author of parts of the Mabinogion were using the same source as the starting point. But the Mabinogion comes years after Chrétien. But in both Chrétien, Percival is a Welshman. In the French, you know, that first French story, and so we're talking. And it's interesting. Did you read the Mabinogion?
Yep. Yeah. I've read it before, but I read it again, and then I had to read it again because it's so weird. You know?
It's like, so weird. And I really liked it, I think. There's something about it that I really liked. But it is kind of spare, where things just, they happen really fast. There's not a lot of description. But so Wolfram, the one that we did last time, happened a few, maybe 50 years after the Chrétien story, but he finishes his, whereas Chrétien only does 9,000 lines. And then there's the, is it four continuators? I didn't know what you were talking about last time, because I didn't read any of the continuations.
Yeah, those are a trip as well.
Did you read them all, or some, or parts?
I read the first one, a big chunk of the second, and then I just traced the Grail thread through all the other ones. Like just traced it. There's big chunks that are just the Grail, and then there's all these other side episodes that go all over the place.
But then I think De Boeren ends up influencing maybe some of the continuations as well, where he starts really overlaying like Christian elements that are like, you know, the Grail becomes the chalice of Christ and where the blood came, you know, so the Lance of Longinus.
Yeah. De Boeren. Yeah. See, I don't know how we're going to do this, because there's so much to this, you know. So, De Boeren is like.
I don't know if we do that one yet. Is it the bridge between? So in back to continuity, my personal feeling is that this is like you were saying, this is a Celtic legend that Chrétien utilized in such a way. I actually liked the romances better than I liked his Grail story.
With Chrétien, you mean?
Yeah. Those, you can see how one of them, it's like, oh, this is like Shakespeare, all the plot, I think. And then there's something really humorous about, like, Lancelot was such an affront because he's the greatest knight. He's clearly the greatest knight ever, and he's French, and he's fucking Arthur's wife.
It's hard to say that, you know. It's
because no, he the, is. The
whole, well, he is, but it's the whole, it's this whole system of courtly love, which is just, that is a massive topic too, right? Like, so how is courtly love connected with the Albigensians or the Cathars of Provence, where the Troubadour movement also comes from at the exact same time?
It wasn't the 60s and free love, but so, like, one of the things I picked up on is maybe the magic of that was this spark of feminism, where maybe I think Joseph Campbell noted that women could ride around and not get raped. And like that was part of the chivalric ethic.
Yeah. So getting back to what Bill said about is it Western literature? Is it go beyond? Campbell says that at that time, like 12th century, there was this kind of arc of the cult of the lady, which stretched all the way from Lady Murasaki in Japan and her story of Genji, right, all the way across into China, into India. There's all these other stories in India, like kind of like devotional love stories, like with Krishna and Radha, and then into the Muslim territories, all the Sufi poems, Sufi poetry, and then Ibn Arabi and Surawardi and all these guys, and that comes up through into Spain, Muslim-controlled Spain, and then into Provence. And so there's the cult of the dame, or the cult of the lady, goes all the way across the supercontinent, Asia and Europe, you know, at around the same time. So clearly something was happening, yeah?
Is it that the men who usually existed on the fringes of the center came upon fringes of other centers, and then there became this retreat back to center, that you didn't have to protect the fringes because the fringes were connected with other fringes, and that once they touched fingers almost out in those outlands, they said, what are we doing out here all by ourselves under the stars when we could be by the fire with the lady? Is it sort of a completion or an idea that home could be safe just as home? It didn't need to be protected, or?
Yeah, there could be elements of that to it as well. But there's also the influence of Platonic philosophy or Neoplatonic philosophy at that time, which really kind of imbues Christian mysticism also, right?
Well, so, shit, we have our first millennium, right? The calendar is in effect by.
Yeah. So there was a massive upheaval for the first millennium up until 1033, which is the millennium of Christ's death and resurrection, right?
What the fuck? That's a hell of an anniversary, right?
So that's what I think is, like, watch out for 2033, you know? It's like we haven't escaped the millennium yet, you know?
We're still in it. No.
but that's the thing, like so you have this kind of upheaval at that time, but also starting at around 800 AD, you have the fall of the Roman Empire, like 476 or whatever, around that time. And then for a few hundred years, there was a kind of chaos. And the only thing holding it together was the sort of decentralized nature of the Western monasteries. And on top of that, these peasant lands, which are basically decentralized as well. And that ended up preserving Western civilization up until you have the crowning of Charlemagne in 800 in southern France as well. And he became the Holy Roman Emperor. Like he was crowned in Rome, became the Holy Roman Emperor. And then things started to congeal around him. And then that's when there was the start of the Matter of France, which was all these chansons de geste based on Charlemagne and all his knights. And so a lot of the kind of stories of the knights come in with the Matter of France, like Roland and all those guys. And then, but at the same time, around that time, that gets called the Carolingian Renaissance, around the 800s, right? But around that time, you have, I'm not sure how you pronounce his name, Eriogena. He's basically a Irish philosopher coming from Ireland, right? Joyce writes about him, right? So does Yeats. He came from Ireland, I think, at the request of Charlemagne or part of his court. And he was the one guy in Europe at the time. I think there's another guy. There's two guys that are mentioned who could speak and read and write Greek and be able to translate it into Latin, right? Which was the lingua franca of the educated classes in Europe at that time, right? And so he was translating all of these mystical writings, like Christian mystical writings that were written in Greek into Latin, and then making his own commentaries, his own philosophy based on this. Like he was translating Maximus the Confessor, and he was translating Dionysius the Areopagite, like in this idea of the negative theology. And that stems directly from Neoplatonism. And so there's this whole strain of Neoplatonic thought that entered into Europe at that time. And the basis of Neoplatonic thought a lot of it comes from Plato's Symposium, right? Which is the his sort of doctrine of love, right? And how through love, how from the apprehension of beauty, we can sort of rise up the ladder of being and then appreciate pure love. And so at that time, that's when it enters in with Eriogena into southern France. And then there's this huge fusion with all this Neoplatonic, recently translated Neoplatonic writings, and then interpretations of the Bible, especially the Song of Solomon, right? Which is the other amazing treatise on love from the Western tradition. And those two things come together. And so there's this whole new thinking about love and then the lady and honoring the lady and using the lady as a means of mystical enlightenment, basically.
Yes.
What about the socio-economic?
An infinite source.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
that's
bottomless. Yeah, the horn of plenty, right? Like you're saying.
Well, what about the socioeconomic component? So I think we touched on this last time of like 1% stuff, and I think this is still very much 1% stuff, right?
Well, it's hard to say.
So they had a little.
I think it's simpler than 1%.
Well, I was just reading about this guy, Eugène Aroux, who is this French kind of like, I don't know, mystic or researcher, or philosopher, like kind of magician type, occult type from the 19th century, right? And so he went back to all these legends and myths and legends and Arthurian romances. And his conclusion was that basically, all these guys, the troubadours and then the trouvères of northern France, of which Chrétien was one of them, right? And then the mini singers in Germany, and then the bards in Britain and stuff. This is all kind of stretching out from Provence, which at that time was hotbed of the Albigensian religion, right? And remember, there was a massive crusade against the Albigensians in the beginning of the we're looking at the beginning of the 13th century. Basically, they wiped out the religion, right? But his theory is that, and he's not sympathetic. He's totally against these guys. But he thinks that that's how it survived, is through poetry. And Bill was talking about before, like the good news, right? So what is the good news? It's the Albigensian or Cathari interpretation of the gospel, right?
Oof.
That gets spread in secret through these romances and spread all throughout Europe.
The romances are doing multiple things, though, because there is like this Top Gun, Tom Cruise element to all these night tales.
Yeah. Sorry. What I wanted to add, though, is Aru was like saying it first starts being a 1% thing with William of Poitiers, yeah, who was the grandfather of Eleanor, right? And Eleanor was the mother, Queen Eleanor is the mother of Marie de Champagne. Marie de Champagne, who is the patroness of Chrétien, right? Anyways, her great grandfather, I guess, William of Poitiers, was the first troubadour, and that was about 1100, right? So Aru was saying, yeah, that's when it surfaced and became kind of an elite aristocratic 1% thing. But there's no doubt that it must have percolated through the lower classes a long time before that, maybe a couple centuries even before that, before in oral history, right? Before it, the troubadours became kind of an aristocratic and elite thing.
What are troubadours? Troubadours sync words with music, right? And the words and the music literally have no relation to each other. And a troubadour could sing any words over the same music, depending on the audience, right? And it's weaponized. The troubadours somehow took the lance, which is the pen, which is the creative act, and weaponized it into the sword. And this is such a huge flip-flop in the Grail mythology, is the protection of the Grail. Is it the lance that protects the Grail, or is it the sword that protects the Grail? Right? And it seems like the Grail vacillates between the sword and the lance. So I tend to say that it leans towards media rather than the biological. As someone who feels spiritually castrated for most of my life, you know, like... the word became a sword to some extent. I lean more towards the gnosis, the Gnosticism at all. But you guys are both married with children, you know? And so your Grail quest has a much different dimension than mine. But the thing that unites us is media in 2024.
I don't know. I think last time Znora was saying, what if it's a literal Grail?
It's not a literal. You can't.
It might be.
No, anything that is hyperdimensional can't be frozen into something permanent. That's the whole tragedy. The Greeks understood. The Greeks understood. Like, we got this shit. Fuck. Nothing is permanent.
What did I say, Doug? I don't think I was unambiguous with anything, but what was it?
The Grail is the Grail.
Like,
the Grail, what is the Grail?
Yeah, the Grail is the transdimensional object that it's almost like the Christ, right?
Trans and hyper are two totally different dimensions. Hyper is all encompassing. Trans is parallel. You can skip to it. Well, like you have some sort of...
So it's almost like the Grail is the way back to Eden.
No.
Yeah, that's one way to think of it as okay, so another way to think of it, right, is that you also have this guy in the 12th century, Joachim de Fior, right? And Joachim mm-hmm. de Fior had mm-hmm. the prophecy of the three ages, right? So you said yep. there was the age of God, and then the age of Christ, starting with the incarnation, and then finally, and he worked it out to around 1260 AD, and he died before that. But he was saying this is the onset of the age of spirit, and the age of spirit, the church would sort of die away, and there would be direct access to the spirit at that time, well, right?
Because electricity was known then.
But yeah, just wait though. So at that time, then that's what the Grail is a kind of a symbol of the onset of the age of spirit, right? Like, that's yes. another way of looking at the
perfect
of
this movement or this. Keep going. Sorry, I'm interrupting.
No, that's fine. You go ahead.
Well, electricity was known by the Egyptians, right? It might have been in a fuzzy, fractalized form, but they were getting sparks in the dark. They knew something was underlying that they could manifest through specific measurements of action. And that just grew and grew and grew. But they could never quite control the spirit, but they could. There was a theater to Egypt, right? I mean, their whole history is a graphic novel.
Right.
We have fallen back into an Egyptian's understanding of spirit. / electricity. We are so drowning in the blood of the Grail that we forgot that we're in a cup or something. Because we just take electricity for granted, like this miracle that we're talking that we've never met in person, and that I feel like you're closer to me than most human beings that I see it in a daily basis, right? we just gloss over that. but these motherfuckers are saying no, like human beings are meant to like drink from the same cup as it's just a cup. I mean, but like, you know what I'm saying? Like, and these books were like, isn't the monolith a Grail? I mean, isn't it?
Yeah, like taking it forward, right? Like if we want to take it forward from this period, like 12th century, take the Grail story forward. It goes everywhere, you know. It's everywhere. It's in all different literature. And then we can take it forward to like going from books to different media. Like there's so many. There's been so many movies, for example, directly made about King Arthur and the Grail.
In Future King in middle school.
You had the
700 page book. I read it on a fucking airplane on a trip to Jamaica. How privileged is that shit? But I'm saying I don't think any of my sophomores could read The Once or Future King and get out of it what I got out of it in eighth grade.
Yeah, yeah.
So what is that? Yeah. Was I as mature as the eighth graders of today? I don't know. But my relationship to the Grail, they poured something into wooden fibers that has remained as fresh of a broth as anything.
Yeah, so that's a miracle too. Like reading
that's a miracle. And they understood. They said, oh my God, this is deeper than blood.
Right.
There's something in the blood that's in everything.
Yeah,
there is
somehow,
no cup. We're in the cup. We are the
somehow
blood.
Somehow language transmits that. You know, it's like a. If we're talking about media, right? It's like that's like McLuhan said, that's the basis of it is language, right? Like that's the root of it. Still, you know.
He understood we were slipping into something more. He understood that we were our movement in temperature. He knew that we were moving in a climate, right? Everything he's talking about is climate based, hot and cold, right? He said, how can I get you to understand the impact of this? Hot and cold. What is the number one issue? Climate apocalypse. Going to get too hot, and then they go, you're full of shit, look, it's too cold, and they go, no, that's because of it's too hot or some shit. But it's because we haven't mentioned any phallic interpretations of this, the lance and the grail and the thing.
Well, yeah, sure, that's all the that's all the.
Why isn't that enough? Why shouldn't it end there?
Well, yeah. Just because the phallic thing didn't end there either. You know, it's like from Weston's point of view, right? That's the exoteric view of it, of the fertility myth, right? Like there is this a cycle of growth and decay and regrowth in the world that we see all the time from season to season, right? But on top of that, there's an esoteric interpretation of that where through that you're reaching towards spirit, right? And
yes.
And so she's saying both of those things are occurring all the way back, like from
for sure.
From stories from like 3000 BC, right? Where you yes. First find these cult of Tammuz, right? In Mesopotamia, right? But there's always this sort of esoteric side, which is reaching towards the divine, right? And these things run parallel all the way through. And so that's the interesting thing is trying to find that within. You can find both within these stories, right?
We talk about the Great Pyramids as something so unbelievable. Where did it come from? How do they still stand, right? And yet we have books that still stand, right?
Yeah.
It took human beings to continually recreate them, so that we got them here. Now that they're here, they're here for eternity. As much as our definition of eternity is now completely in spirit.
Yeah, you have that one story from Gurdjieff and Meetings of Remarkable Men, where he was just journeying through the way out into the mountains of Central Asia. And he came across this tribe of people completely illiterate and illiterate always, like for countless generations going back. But they had storytellers, right? And these storytellers were telling the story of Gilgamesh, which is the first written story, right? Like, where do they come with that? You know? that's what we're dealing with here. You know, it's like that's the power behind it. Doug, what? How about you? Where did you? What was your journey from Wolfram to Kretschmann? Like, how did things change for you or evolve?
We're going to have to hear that on the other side because that was 42 minutes.
Get the fuck out of here.
We didn't even get to the thing.
No, we didn't. You've been listening to 42 Minutes. This is the Book Club, production of Sync Book Radio, and thesyncbook.com. For more information about the Sync Book, our guests, to check out past shows, or to subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, please be sure and visit our website at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, check out our others. It's currently all the Sync Book Radio archives are free. All this and more can be found at thesyncbook.com. Thank you so much. And says he already has got one.